You know, the Lufthansa heist would have been the equivalent of about $21 million in today's money, nearly all of it cash, all sitting around in an airport warehouse. And how, you have to ask, how could some wise guys pull this off? No one was killed during the robbery itself, but a lot of people died afterward. We'll hear the story of the heist, how it went down, and the bloody aftermath, and then we'll open up the phones with some of your questions and comments during this hour with my guest, Daniel Simone, author of The Lufthansa Heist. Much more to come here on Coast to Coast AM. So, Daniel, let's get into the heist itself. Who gave the tip to the guys, to the gang?
One of the Lufthansa shipping clerks, his name was Lewis Werner, another degenerate gambler, was indebted to an associate of Henry Hill, a bookmaker, to the tune of $22,000. And of course, when the bookmaker began applying pressure on Lewis Werner, offered an alternative. Presented the possibility that providing details of how to foray into the Lufthansa cargo terminal and be able to walk out with millions of dollars. And the bookmaker, of course, knowing that he would never get paid otherwise, brought this to the attention of Henry Hill. Henry Hill brought it to the attention of Jimmy Burke, and Jimmy Burke assembled, first of all, planned meticulously how this robbery could be executed. Of course, Lewis Werner had provided the details and particulars necessary for Jimmy Burke to work with, and then Jimmy Burke assembled his team of gunmen, who ultimately assaulted the night crew. And of course, that was the beginning of how the robbery began.
Now, these guys are thieves and street scufflers and stick-up men and bookies, loan sharks, that kind of stuff. But they're not master criminals, master thieves. They didn't think it was possible in the beginning, right?
Well, by no stretch of the imagination, they were massive thieves. In fact, most of them, if not all of them, were illiterate to a great extent. But there was also rumors or there was an understanding that the Lufthansa cargo terminal was one of the most secure, and no one would dare even think about attempting such a caper. And of course, this was a fact that had been circulated, but Jimmy Burke, when he told or assured by Lewis Werner that the Lufthansa cargo terminal was just as easy to get into as all the other European airlines, and convinced of that, Jimmy Burke then proceeded with the plan.
So Lou Werner, he's a degenerate. He'd already been planning on stealing it himself, getting his own crew and stealing it. He had another partner he had blabbed to about it. You know, a lot of people had heard this scuttlebutt already before it comes to Henry Hill's attention. There's already a lot of lips flapping about the whole plan.
Yes, Lewis Werner had already approached others who were not confident at all, but nonetheless, they knew about the fact that Lewis Werner was planning this caper. And as you said, many mouths and tongues were already flapping about it, which did not help keeping it a secret. But the other problem also was the fact that Lewis Werner had a partner, and the partner, Peter Gruenwald, was not aware that Lewis Werner had decided to recruit someone of the ranks of Jimmy Burke to do this. And when Gruenwald found out, he became the first potential threat to turn in and testify against Lewis Werner, which in the end, Gruenwald did in fact do exactly that.
It was interesting that you say that Jimmy Burke, he assigned some pretty heavy muscle guys to do this stuff, some gunmen, some killers to go along on this if necessary, but he gave strict instructions. We don't want to hurt anybody. I mean, and they repeat it several times during the heist. We're not here to hurt you.
That's exactly what Jimmy Burke had ordered. He was emphatic about that because he knew that robbery is one type of crime on one level, and murder is an entirely different felony that would certainly land everyone in prison for life. So yes, they were very, very careful in not hurting anyone, and the casualties were very, very minimal in the end.
Down to, I mean, the Lou Werner gave them a plan. I mean, down to the names of the security guys who worked there. They knew a little bit about all of them. They knew when they took their breaks. They knew that there was one of the older security guys would hide during the night and goof off. They knew all this stuff down to the most minute detail.
Yes, Lewis Werner provided all the most minute details, and that is exactly what facilitated Jimmy Burke's crew to exact the robbery. But most importantly, Lewis Werner assured Jimmy Burke that the Lufthansa cargo terminal was not any safer than any of the others, unlike the general understanding that all the local thieves were under. And of course, the only thing that's also important to mention is that Lewis Werner never met or dealt directly with Jimmy Burke. Jimmy Burke insulated himself from Lewis Werner by having a liaison between him and Werner. And even this liaison, unfortunately for Lewis Werner, he did not know his true identity. So when Lewis Werner was finally arrested and was offered to cooperate with the authorities, Lewis Werner could not even save himself because he couldn't provide the true identity of anyone who was involved in the robbery, including the go-in-between that he had been dealing with.
Let's talk about the cash. Now, I think that going into this, they thought it might be $2 million. That's what they'd been told by Lou Werner. That's an incredibly big score by itself. Of course, as we find out later, it's even much bigger than that. But why is so much cash sitting around in an airport?
Well, the expectation from Lewis Werner was that the money that would be in store in the high value vault to have been approximately $1.5 to $2 million. But what happened is that particular loads of money that was transported back from Europe that particular week happened to be more than the average. But the reason why the cash was left lingering behind inside the high-value vault at the cargo terminal over an entire weekend is because that Friday afternoon, when the Brinks guards came to pick up the money, Lewis Werner made himself unavailable, and because he was a supervising clerk, the procedure that the Lufthansa had instituted was that only a supervisor on duty could authorize the approval of releasing the money to the Brinks guards. And as I mentioned, Lewis Werner made himself unavailable. And after waiting around for a half hour or so, the Brinks guards finally moved on to their next stop, thinking that they would return on Monday morning to pick up this cash that had been left behind. And of course, Lewis Werner had done it intentionally so that the money having been left behind over an entire weekend would give Jimmy Burke's crew the right opportunity to go in there and corral the night staff on duty at the terminal, which was minimal. And this was really the reason why the money was left behind and made available to Jimmy Burke.
So they go in one by one. They overpower the security staff and the employees who were there and put them in cuffs. They made some mistakes, though, some really bad mistakes along the way, taking the masks off, and at least two of them made mistakes where they could be identified.
Yes, they did, and that was really the primary reason that caused everybody's demise. Tommy DeSimone, as we mentioned him earlier in the program, was the individual who had removed his ski mask because he was perspiring, not realizing that by doing so he would expose his face, which was later identified through police mugshot photos. And of course, he was now being sought, and that was the reason why Paul Vario gave John Gotti the green light to kill him.
And again, Tommy DeSimone is the Joe Pesci character from the movie, but he was in real life a real big guy, not a little guy.
Yes,
Yeah.
precisely.
Okay. So they go in. Two of them had exposed their faces so they could be identified. But generally, it goes off pretty well. Other than those mistakes, they get out. Did they take all the cash? Was there more to take, or did they take everything that was available?
They took all the cash that was left in the behind in the high value vault. And interestingly, though, the following morning after the robbery had been announced publicly, Lufthansa estimated the loss to have been approximately $1.5 million. And Jimmy Burke took advantage of that and told his associates, his cohorts, that yes, indeed, the money that he counted, which he counted privately without anyone else around him, yes, the money was in fact approximately $1.5 million, and he promised to share with his associates based on this $1.5 million that he confirmed that Lufthansa had announced. But in fact, Jimmy Burke already knew that the money that they had taken was far, far more than $1.5 million, in fact, totaling nearly $6 million.
So, yeah, over the next couple of weeks, every time you hear a news story about this thing, the total take gets bigger, right?
Yes, Lufthansa kept revising their loss. It went to 2 million, 3, 4, 5, and 6, at which point Burke's gunmen began rebelling. They were demanding more money. And that is when Jimmy Burke launched his murderous spree and eliminated anyone who was pestering him about more money.
We'll talk about that a little bit. I want to talk about the lawmen who get involved, different agencies. This was really a surprise to me how much competition there was among the different agencies, the FBI, local police, the prosecutors, for who gets to take the case. They figured, as you note in the book, in the beginning, they thought, oh, we're going to solve this in no time at all. You have a couple of quotes from them. Yeah, we'll wrap this up real quick. So they all wanted to take credit for it, and it caused a lot of problems for the investigation.
Yes, at first, the Port Authority Chief of Police figured that he would be able to wrap this up in no time at all. And then he learns that there were no clues left behind by the perpetrators. And worse yet, the cash was unmarked, so it would have been difficult to trace or prove that it was actually the money taken from Lufthansa. But of course, because instantly the case began spinning national headlines, naturally all the various law enforcement agencies who were involved in this investigation were clamoring to dominate the investigation and take credit for it. This was the type of case that could make a career. And of course, the FBI promptly got involved. The Port of Authority was the first agency who had jurisdiction over the robbery because it occurred on the grounds of Kennedy Airport. And then, of course, the local and New York City Police Department was involved, the local district attorney, and they all began jousting for the center stage of this phenomenal crime that dominated the headlines for the following 14 months.
And it wasn't just jousting either. You make the case, and you give some pretty specific examples of how it really messed with the investigation, them hiding information from each other and getting into confrontations. You describe one scene where the FBI guy is face-to-face, just about coming to blows with a New York City lieutenant, I think he was.
Yes. Yes, a lieutenant, yes. And of course, they actually sabotaged one another in the course of this investigation, which, had they collaborated rather than unspooled each other's leads, perhaps the end result might have been more fruitful.
So I'm trying to read between the lines. Some of this conflict, was it because some in law enforcement didn't want it solved?
No, not because the various law enforcement agencies independently did not want it solved, but because each one of them was vying for the dominating
the credit,
position,
right,
as the investigating agency, so to take the credit if and when they would solve the crime.
So they had some clues. They figured this is going to be easy. But it seems like, as you describe it, Jimmy the Gent was one step ahead of him. In fact, he was so far ahead of him that they started to suspect he had a plant somewhere in the investigation.
Yes, to be more specific, George, the New York City local detectives knew immediately who was involved in the robbery. They couldn't prove it, but they knew, they had a strong suspicion that it was Jim, the Robert's Lounge gang headed by Jimmy Burke. The Port Authority police also had a pretty good hunch as to who was involved. The FBI, however, was clueless, because the FBI was not as involved in local criminalities as the other agencies, the other local agencies. But of course, as soon as the FBI became apprised as to what happened and who the likely suspects were, immediately they assumed the jurisdiction of the case, and naturally the U.S. attorney immediately took charge of the possible prosecution. And at that point, the local agencies were left with crumbs to bite at. And that's when it all came to blows, literally, as you pointed out a minute ago. And in the end, the FBI won, as they usually do. But unfortunately, by the time Henry Hill decided to become an informant and testify, Henry could no longer provide any valuable information to the FBI, because by that point in time, Jimmy Burke had already eliminated anyone who was directly or indirectly involved. And in the end, the Lufthansa case was never solved by any of the law enforcement agencies.
Yeah, it's amazing. They knew exactly who did it. They knew who was in charge of it, but they never solved it at all.
No, because before the investigators would have an opportunity to interrogate or even arrest their suspects, Jimmy Burke killed them.
And it was like one by one. I mean, it seemed like you detail in order who they were looking at, in order he killed them. Or had him
killed. Yes, indeed he did. And it is a strong possibility, in my opinion, that Jimmy, not a possibility, a probability, that Jimmy Burke must have had a mole inside every single one of the law enforcement agencies that I mentioned.
Well, the first guy to go is Stax, the driver. He drives the van and is supposed to go take the van that was used in one part of the robbery, take it to a John Gotti-controlled junkyard and have it smashed and go away, but he messes up.
Yes, instead he diverted his to one of his girlfriend's apartments in the vicinity of Kennedy Airport, and he parked the van nearby a fire hydrant and fell asleep. And the following morning, while he was sleeping, or perhaps in a stupor of drugs or alcohol, a routine police officer spotted the van, as I mentioned, nearby the fire hydrant, illegally parked. And upon further inspection, this cop noticed that this might have been the getaway van from the Lufthansa robbery the night before. And the van was impounded. Stax's fingerprints were lifted off the van, and now Stax became a person of interest. And of course, for that very reason, logically, Jimmy Burke had to do away with him, and he became the first casualty.
Yeah, he was going to get it regardless for messing up that badly, leaving it there, even though he was a childhood, lifelong friend of Tommy DeSimone, the Joe Pesci character. He had to go. I'll tell you what, we'll pick that up, get into sort of the list of who else had to go in what order, talk about the John Gotti connection, because he sent one of his henchmen along on the heist, and then open up the phone lines with your questions and comments for my guest, Daniel Simone, talking about the Lufthansa heist. We're talking with Daniel Simone about his book, The Lufthansa Heist, and the trail of blood that led from that heist. A lot of people died as a result of their involvement. Jimmy the Jet Burke eliminating all the witnesses. We're going to pick up that story and then take a couple of your calls and comments from my guest right after this on Coast to Coast AM. So we're talking about the trail of carnage that follows the Lufthansa heist. Stacks, the guy who drives the van and is supposed to dispose of the van, messes up, gets loaded with his girlfriend. The van gets caught. There's a bunch of evidence in there, not only fingerprints, but I think some of the masks that have been used in the robbery. Tommy DeSimone, the Joe Pesci character, gets the order. You got to go take care of this guy, even though you've been friends with him since you were kids. It's your job. Go do it. And he does, right?
Yes, he does, reluctantly, but with the promise that he would be sponsored to be a candidate as a made man. He did, in fact, carry out the execution of Stacks, but of course, he himself later was also murdered, and the gunman was John Gotti himself.
So it's like in the movie, in the Goodfellas movie, where the Joe Pesci guy goes to a ceremony. He thinks he's going to get the button. He's going to become a made man. And instead, he walks into a room and he's murdered. And as you say in the book, it's John Gotti is the guy who pulls the trigger.
Yes, correct. John Gotti did so because of an old beef that John Gotti held to himself. Tommy DeSimone, years earlier, had killed two of John Gotti's earners, two of his top earners, but John Gotti couldn't prove it. And without proof, he couldn't get approval from his family's boss and the boss of the Lucchese crime family. In such an event, when getting approval to kill a made man or even an associate of another family, the bosses of both families would have to approve it. And because John Gotti did not have solid evidence to present, he basically let it go. But once he learned that there was a possibility that Tommy DeSimone was about to get his button, as you pointed out, to become a made man, John Gotti would not stand for that, and he asked permission to kill him. And of course, given the circumstances that John Gotti provided, he was given the green lights to kill him.
And it served two purposes, right? Because by that point, they knew that Tommy DeSimone had made a mistake and that somebody might be able to identify him. So getting rid of him would also help probably Big Pauly and Jimmy the Gent Burke.
Yes, that is precisely the reason why the killing was immediately approved, and it had a twofold purpose. Tommy DeSimone was already being sought by the local NYPD, New York City Police Department. So if he had been arrested and interrogated, there was that the great risk that he could have possibly testified against everyone else.
I was amazed in the book you talk about so many of these guys who are involved in it. Once they start hearing that it's not 1.5, it's not 2 million, it's 6 million, they're griping and complaining to Jimmy Burke, demanding their money. And I'm thinking to myself, you know, I've seen the movie. I know what kind of guy he is. I wouldn't pitch too much of a stink about it because, as it turned out, the people who complained the loudest, they got whacked.
Yes, they kept pestering Jimmy Burke, and that was the second motivation for Jimmy Burke to kill them. The first motivation was not to risk that any one of them potentially could have become a witness against them. And, of course, the second reason was a business decision to eliminate them and save paying them their due share. Ellie Hill was smart enough not to have made any such demand because he watched everyone else being killed for it, and he accepted a small token of money that Jimmy Burke gave him, $5,000 or $6,000, and he didn't dare ask for any more.
Do you have an idea how much money Jimmy Burke paid out of the 6 million, how much he actually turned over to his Confederates?
The six gunmen who were physically involved in the robbery received an average of $15,000 to $20,000 each. Lewis Werner received $17,000, with the promise that the more was coming, but of course he was arrested and he never got anything else. And Paul Vario, Jimmy Burke paid Paul Vario $450,000 and paid John Gotti $200,000, who squandered all of it within a week at the local racetrack.
And I think I think it was your book, or maybe it was, I've read it in an additional account, but that Jimmy Burke also blew a big wad of the money on some kind of scheme.
Yes, Jimmy Burke did this, blow some of the money on a drug deal that he had been defrauded out of. And also, Jimmy Burke gambled here and there, gave away some money to those he owed from the past. But for the most part, in according to my findings, Jimmy Burke did manage to keep most of it.
So the bulk of the money, what happened to it?
The bulk of the money, in my opinion, although there's no evidence of it, was ultimately left in the hands of one of Jimmy Burke's daughters. But again, I don't have anything to support my suspicion. But based on what I've read and discovered, and with certain sources that help me trace the bulk of the money, I would say that it would be accurate that Jimmy Burke's daughter wound up with it.
It's amazing, isn't it, that they knew so much about the crime and who did it, and were never able to get any of the ringleaders. And of course, eventually Henry Hill figures it out that he's next on the list, right? Even though he's not cooperating, he gets in trouble for drugs, and once he's in trouble, they start putting the pressure on him. They figure he's got to go, right?
Well, yes, and even though he had decided that he would not testify, but the FBI reasoned with Henry that whether he testified or not, meaning if he went to trial or accepted whatever punishment awaited him, either way, Henry Hill's former associates, particularly Paul Vario, would have killed them because he would not have risked that one day Henry Hill would awaken in his cell and decide that he didn't want to spend the rest of his life in a 4x8 closet. So either way, whether Henry Hill decided to take his lumps by himself and keep silent or testify, he was a dead man, and for that reason, and he ultimately decided the best course of action was to enlist in the Federal Witness Protection Program.
I'm going to go to the phones here in a second. One last question, and then we'll take some calls. But Henry Hill was not exactly a model for the Witness Protection Program. He was a mess, right?
Yes, he was. He blew his cover on three different occasions. Henry would immediately introduce himself to his new neighbors wherever the federal marshals would locate him. And sure enough, he would host backyard parties, barbecues, and of course, after a few drinks, he would start to tell stories about his days of glory and reveal his true identity. At that point, the federal marshals were of course, compelled to relocate him for his own safety. And after the third time that Henry Hill blew his cover, they finally told him, you know what, you're on your own. And he was ultimately expelled from the program.
Was there anybody looking for him at that point?
Evidently not,
Yeah.
because if they were, they certainly could have found him. But I would it would be safe to assume that by that point in time, all potential threats were basically gone.
Let's take a couple of calls. We got Pistol Pete in Connecticut, who says he's a friend of Henry Hill's and knows you, Daniel. Hi, Pistol Pete. How you doing?
Hi, George. Good evening and good morning, Daniel.
Good morning,
George.
To you.
Lisa Caserta passes her love to you.
Oh, thank you.
I spoke with her earlier, along with Daniel. Last time I spoke with you, George, Henry was supposed to be on the show. It was April 2012, and
yeah.
Lisa's Lisa Zahn had passed away, and you had Frank Collada on that evening.
Right, right. That's right. Yeah.
Daniel, I wanted to ask you two questions. The first one is, are you involved with the point shaving scandal movie that may be coming out?
Not at present. No, I'm not.
Not at present. And then the second question I had is, what is the advantage of writing a true story in the style of a novel?
Well, writing in the style of a novel is far more appealing to a broader audience because it has all the elements that appeal to just about everyone. For example, a housewife can find it entertaining, a lawyer can find it entertaining, as well as a true crime fan. Whereas if the story is written as a basic nonfiction style, it may only appeal to those interested in crime. It may not appeal to a doctor or a housewife or a woman in general. So writing in the style of a novel has all the elements requisite to make the story lively and create characters that the reader or the audience can relate to. And of course, it is far more entertaining.
Thanks, Pete. Appreciate it. Yeah, I enjoyed it. It did read like a novel. It's nonfiction, of course, but it does read like a novel. And I know you take some liberties in recreating conversations, but you note in the book that it's always based on fact. It's a great way to tell the story. We're going to go west of the Rockies. Wayne in Tacoma has a question about the vault. Hi, Wayne.
Good evening, gentlemen. Yes, my question was about the vault itself. Usually most reasonably secure vaults like Mosul or ISM have time locks on them, so they can only be operated during the work day, and then on weekends, of course, they're automatically locked all weekend. What went wrong, or why didn't they have a reasonably good vault door, and what made it easy for them to get into it? Did somebody there have the combination at nighttime?
Well, in actuality, Wayne, it was not a vault, a conventional vault, a safe, if you will. It was really a room, a cinder block room with a steel door, with two steel doors, actually. And the alarm system was not really that sophisticated, particularly during that period. So this was not a massive cast iron vault that one would imagine that you would find at a bank, for example. It was really nothing more than a cinder block room that anybody could have easily penetrated.
But it was kind of tricky, though, as you describe in the book. It's kind of tricky. There's a special key to it, and then there were alarms that had to be disabled in a right order. Any wrong step anywhere along the way would have set off an alarm.
Yes, but all those hurdles, all those problems were overcome by simply putting a gun to the supervisor's head and ordering him to open the vault.
Right. Thank you. Thanks for the call, Wayne. East of the Rockies, Charles McKinney in Ohio. Charles, I think, says that maybe part of the story is based on him. Hi, Charles.
How you doing?
What's your tale?
I wanted to say that I originally did the screenplay for that movie. The Hollywood execs wouldn't let me do it because I'm a black man, and they let Ray Liotta take over. You can ask Ray, you can ask Bob De Niro. Bob De Niro was going to leave the set because they wouldn't let me do the picture. I had to beg them to stay on, but they didn't know that was my picture.
What, do you have some kind of connection? Do you know these guys? You knew the story in some way?
Well, I had been dealing with people like Lucky Luciano, Sam Giancana, Big Paul, Carlos Gambino, Joey Gallo, John Gotti, all of them kind of folks.
You had what kind of dealings with them? What dealings did you have with them? What dealings are you talking about?
You know those names, don't you?
I do, yeah. What dealings did you have with those people? Lucky Luciano, that was a long time ago. What dealings did you have with him?
He was cleaning in 1964 when I was a little boy.
Okay. When you were a little boy, you were dealing with Lucky Luciano?
That's right.
All right. Well, we're sorry you got screwed out of that movie, Charles. Thank you for the call. Daniel, So at the end of Henry Hill's life, he's on his own. How does he make a living?
Well, that's an interesting point. He made a living. He wasn't making a living until he met his last and final wife, Lisa Caserta. And she, having been a publicist by trade and a businesswoman attached to the entertainment industry, more or less created a program where Henry availed himself to any locality who would host a sit-down dinner, as he called it, and basically it evolved into something that became of very popular and successful.
You know, the first caller had mentioned something about the point shaving scandal, which we haven't even touched on, but that's a big part of the book. At the same time that this whole heist is unfolding, Henry has something else going. It was potentially enormous for the mob, and that is he had a couple of basketball players who had agreed to cooperate and shave points.
Yes, he did, exactly.
And how did it work out?
Well, it didn't really work out as successful as Henry and Jimmy Burke originally hoped or planned. Some money was made, but in the end, on an average, when all said was done, the ledger was full of red ink, and it was actually a loss.
Is there a movie project in the works about that?
A documentary was broadcast by ESPN, one of the 30 for 30 series that is broadcast weekly. It carried that documentary about a year and a half ago, and lately in the news there's been talk about the possibility of adapting the documentary to a television series.
Talk about Jimmy Burke. He had so many people killed around him to insulate himself for the Lufthansa heist, but he still met an end that didn't go well for him.
Well, yes, after a year and a half of the FBI debriefing Henry, of course, Henry could not really be of any assistance in prosecuting anyone involved in the Lufthansa case because everyone had already been murdered. But then suddenly, Henry recalled another incident that Jimmy Burke was involved in. Jimmy Burke had killed a drug dealer whom had defrauded him out of money. And when Henry Hill mentioned this to the FBI, they were able to piece together a pretty solid case, and Jimmy Burke was retried again and convicted for murder. And subsequently, he died in prison.
Was there remorse on Henry Hill's part for turning on Jimmy Burke? They had been close for so long.
In my opinion, yes, he was very remorseful and guilt-ridden, although he never confessed that to me in simple terms, but he did provide me many, many hints that he was very heavily guilt-ridden for that very reason, yes.
Well, even though Jimmy Burke was going to have him killed.
Well, yes, but Henry Hill understood that there would have been good reason for Jimmy Burke to kill him. So he understood that Jimmy Burke meant nothing personal. It was strictly business.
You know, we started the conversation talking about this trial that ended in November. It was almost comical to go after this 80-year-old guy, I mean, that had was on the fringes of the mob but really had little to do with the crime. There's still some of those guys around, aren't there?
Yes, but they are basically remnants. And in my opinion, current mafia, or what is left of it, is nothing more than an archaic, once mighty giant whose effectiveness has evaporated and is presently awaiting extinction. The few remaining remnants are no longer a faction of an organized criminal empire. Rather, they're now a pathetic, weakened group of disorganized felons.
A lot of other organized crime groups have moved in to fill the vacuum. Daniel Simone, thanks very much for being with us. The Lufthansa Heist is a great read. I hope people will check it out. Thank you, and maybe we'll talk to you again if you have another project. Still to come, Nafiz Ahmed to talk about the pre-COG program the Pentagon's been spending money on for the last 25 years.